His boots steamed. He turned them to let the heel sides dry and pulled out the tongues. He eyed the boots critically. It would be important to take them off the stove before they were absolutely crisp, or else the leather would ossify. Then he would get blisters on the next march, and the company didn't slow for blisters. You marched until they burst, and then until the flesh rubbed raw. Blisters were the true reason the men hated the enemy. The invasion of Poland was terrible, of course, but at least it was an event that had taken place outside of everyone's boots. He returned to his cot and tried to make sense of the letter. He hadn't slept since reaching the barracks at 7 that morning and collapsing at the gate. The high, whining sound was still in his ears. He read the first paragraph again. Dimly, he understood that his friend, Tom, was writing to him from the point of view of their stuffed cat. Caesar, he could call to mind easily, fluid and feline, as he stalked the old garret. He found it harder to recall Tom's face, and when he did so, it was confounded with elements of Duggan's. The man had been so pale, prone on the red grass in the red bloom of the sunrise. His lips had seemed dark as cocoa, although of course they must have been blue. The red light had been blind to the colour. The dark lips had moved for a while. Duggan had said something, but Alistair's ears were blown. The lips, excused from their colour, had formed words relieved of their sound. He noticed his hands holding the thin blue paper of the letter. Despite the shower he had taken, there was a black residue under his fingernails and in the creases of his knuckles. He had tried to hold Duggan's head up. He remembered it now. As if we hadn't all to drown.
Last night, Tom took Mary to see a show at the Hammersmith. I wasn't invited, I must disgustedly observe, but from what ensued upon their return, I must conclude that the evening went well.
Ah, Alistair, I always said you were astute for a human.
You noticed straight away, of course, that I wrote upon their return. And yes, it is quite true. Abandoning propriety, Tom invited Mary to inspect the old garret, and inspect it she did.
You should have seen the scorn with which she surveyed the living arrangements. I'm quite sure that she was one of your regimental sergeant majors in a past life.
And then, before Tom walked her home, the two of them danced to the gramophone and...
Oh, I tell you what, I can't be bothered to be the cat anymore. Mary's a knockout, Alistair. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And I'm grateful to you for making me go through with that first dinner.
The residue on his fingers troubled him now. He put the letter down and ran hot water into a washbasin in the row at the end of the dormitory. He dipped his hands and let them soak. The blood dissolved from his fingers. It leached in tiny red clouds, escaping from each fold of skin and diffusing until the water in the white basin turned a pale orange. He dried his hands on his vest.
The thing is, Alistair, I'm keener on her than she is on me. I know she wants me to give her a job, and I fear that as soon as she realizes I have no job to give her, then she will be off. And then, of course, there is the issue of her social standing.
Alistair closed his eyes, thinking of their gramophone, the Columbia portable with its shabby leatherette case. When one opened it up, there was unannounced wonder. The burnished plano reflecto tone arm, the plush red platter that the discs spun upon, glossy debs on a velveteen settee. It was perfectly built for peacetime, the balance of the tone arm assuming a stable foundation, the calm government of its rotation implying an excess of time. Since she is of an entirely different social class, and I cannot help but think that her interest in me might have more to do with what her family will think than with what she feels, but perhaps I am underestimating her.
Perhaps you are thinking that I simply ought to take my courage in both hands and...
Alistair let the letter fall. He wondered what they had danced to. Al Bowley was the thing that season. Hold my hand, if Tom had dared. Lying on his cot, Alistair heard the music quite clearly in his mind. He thought of Tom dancing with the girl, and he was happy. Sleep came, finally, with the music swelling into the vacuum in his mind, where there had been only that high, thin whining. The gramophone spun, and he slept, with the letter still in his hand. He had kissed Duggan as he was dying. It had seemed the only thing to do. The company stood around Alistair's cot now. No one spoke. One man brought a blanket and laid it over him. Another took Alistair's boots from the paraffin heater before they desiccated, and rubbed black polish into them, and buffed them up, and aligned them carefully on his locker. There was always an inspection at dawn. March 1940. At breakfast, Palmer brought the post on a pewter tray. The silver was used only when Mary's father was in residence, this being one of a hundred idiosyncrasies that might have originated in some long-forgotten instruction from the family, or arisen spontaneously from the coppery circuitry in Palmer's internal machinery that gauged what was fitting. If Palmer were lost to them, along with the stock of method and law of which he alone was the repository, then Mary felt sure the family would be obliged to disband. They would screech apart from one another as atoms released from their bond. Palmer, then, with the Morning Post, on the pewter tray that lent the white envelopes an oysterish hue.
"Oh," said Mary, "here's another one from Zachary."
"But look here," said Hilda, "you are hardly the nigger's mother."
"No, I dare say I would have noticed."
Hilda, who hadn't Mary's facility for overlooking Palmer's hovering presence, coloured slightly. Mary took Zachary's letter from the envelope.
"I hope you don't encourage him by replying," said Hilda. "Darling, I wrote to him first. Anyway, must you call him nigger? It doesn't seem entirely big-hearted."
Hilda yawned.
"I'll say 10 Hail Marys. The negroes are no viler than we, you know. In faculty, fitness, and faith, they are our perfect equal."
"Hardly," said Hilda.
"But I've nothing against them. I might even prefer them to other foreigners, since at least one knows where one stands."
"Does one?"
"Well, one really oughtn't to write to one."
"Stop it," said Mary.
"Anyway, this won't be writing so much as marking the child's work. Honestly, look at this. Dear Miss North, I do not like the village. The other children are very mean. I do not like the house where I am staying. The woman is very, very mean."
Hilda squinted at the pencil work.
"How old do you say the child is?"
"He's 10.
"And this is him writing with his fingers or his toes? Only I've heard they have equal facility with both."
"Oh, tosh. His fingers are used for the extraction of nasal mucus or for counting when under duress. His feet are reserved for football. He's no different from any other boy, you see, except that his spelling is quite original. He's a perfect spark, only no one bothers to teach the negroes properly."
Hilda sniffed. "He spells as if he has picked up a job lot of letterees on the cheap and now is anxious to offload them. But wouldn't you? If I'd never been taught to spell, I dare say I might chuck in an E whenever a reasonable doubt arose."
"You're saying you can't blame him?"
Mary gave an approving look. "Now you're getting it." "The other children chase me, and when they catch me, they take off my clothes and they hurt me with sticks or knives. Please help me."
Mary's smile froze. "Yes," said Hilda, reading over her shoulder. "But children exaggerate, don't they?"
"And I am so cold. It is so cold here. Please help."
Mary put the letter down on the pewter tray.
"I'm quite sure it can't be so bad as all that," said Hilda. "With my nephews, one simply has to remind them to jolly well wear a jumper."
"Perhaps I ought to go to him."
"Yes, and perhaps you should knit him balaclavas and bake him flapjacks iced with your tears and send him woolen socks."
"Oh, do put a woolen sock in it."
"But he is in the Cotswolds, darling, not the Crimea."
Mary ignored her.
"I will go to see the child's father."
Hilda snorted.
"No, really, I will talk to him and express my concerns."
"But what good will that do?"
"He probably doesn't understand our system. He most likely does not realise that he has a perfect right to bring his son back home.
Sorry to nitpick, said Hilda, but you see, there's a war.
Yes, but do you really think they'll be bombing? This beastly thing has droned on for how long now?
6 months.
And the only pasting we've had is with posters urging valour.
Even so, you're hardly going to tell the father to bring the boy home.
Surely it is my duty to tell him that he could. This is the thing, you see. Unless one more or less lives with the authorities, as I do, one probably doesn't understand that one can simply say no thank you.
So, you are planning to walk into a Negro family's house.
I was planning to knock.
And tell them what they should do with their child.
What they could usefully do,
yes. Notwithstanding your belief that they are just as intelligent as us.
Mary frowned. You are a mousetrap of a friend. All soft cheese and hard springs.
I use you for practice. One day I'll have a husband.
Mary took a second envelope from the tray.
God help the poor man.
God will take my side, said Hilda. He's only human, after all.
Oh, said Mary, blushing slightly. This one's from Tom.
Come on, read it out.
Mary drew Tom's letter closer.
I think I might rather...
Oh, go on, don't be such a prude.
It's just that I'd...
A cough came from the end of the breakfast room, by the double doors, which had swung open soundlessly. Palmer's cough had the twin qualities of apology and watershed. Mary thought him the very best.
Miss Hilda,
he said.
Yes?
I have taken the opportunity to stop a cab for you.
Hilda blinked.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you, Palmer.
The imperceptible nod. The dispassionate eyes, already fading from memory. Palmer's face had the property of oneness with the crockery and the dado rails, while his structuring of the day had the feature of seeming contiguous with one's own desires, so that Hilda, even as she stood, must already be convinced that she had somehow wanted the taxi. Mary supposed that an asset like Palmer would be a supreme unguent in these times of heightened stress at the ministries. She felt a twinge of apprehension at the thought that he might be requisitioned. She kissed Hilda on both cheeks, waved her off down the steps into the drizzling morning, and opened Tom's letter in the hallway. Dear Miss North, so. Tom was Miss Northing her, on headed notepaper from the Education Authority. Mary thought she might fall down. She leaned against the hall stand with its cut glass jar of peonies. She hadn't thrown wine over Tom at their last dinner. Nor had she gone the other way, undressing over dessert. All she had done, and this hardly seemed to merit the official stationery treatment, was to have drunk slightly too much and to have asked him, quite politely, if he wouldn't mind kissing her.
Dear Miss North, from the records of this office, I see that, following your release from your posting to Hawley Street School, you have no current role with the authority.
Mary felt that she might cry. It wasn't as if she had hidden it.
I note also your several requests to this office to be allowed to resume your war service in teaching.
Oh, perhaps she had slightly nagged him. But she had been quite fun about the whole thing, or at least she had tried to be, and the awkward truth of it was that she really did want to teach, and she really did like him. Perhaps she had been clumsy in asking to have both. She read Tom's next line through splayed fingers, in case it was too awful for words. I am therefore pleased to inform you of your selection by this office for a new position that has been created at Hawley Street School. You are to report to... Mary read no further until she was already in a cab. You are to report to these offices to collect keys and then make the building ready. You are to select one classroom of robust construction with access to basement or cellar in case of air raid. You are to make arrangements in anticipation of a class of mixed ages and abilities. If Tom's intention had been to avoid any appearance of impropriety by keeping the communication official, then she rather subverted it by rushing to his office, dragging him out to the cafe over the road, and drinking only 3 sips of tea before kissing him on the cheek. He touched his face as if her lips might have left a tangible remainder, a smoking impact crater, or an epistolary X with the ink still wet below the signature. Later,
when she was alone in the raw, wet wind, strangers smiled at her in the street. It was eerie. The raindrops were champagne bubbles bursting on her skin. The iridescent spills of fuel oil on the wet tarmac of the road were tiny proofs of the covenant. She supposed she must be in love. That Tom was slightly infuriating, and that she didn't mind in the slightest, might be proof of it. And of course, it would be nice if he were more daring about the whole thing, but she could be patient. Soon Tom would realise that there was nothing more important than Mary North, that it was only her sorcery causing the planets to stay aligned and preventing the milk from curdling. Almost as strange as being in love was being in it with someone she liked, someone her mother would not countenance nor Hilda even consider. Without the war, how would one ever meet an ordinary man like Tom? And here was what she wanted to know, now that she had left the cafe and London closed around her with its smell of coal smoke and lorry exhaust and tube ventings and railway grease and frying and horse droppings and wet masonry and exhaled cigarettes and damp worsted overcoats and quick brown water coursing in the gutters and slow brown water infusing with disintegrating newsprint in the puddles along with the flotilla of butts already smoked. Here was what she wanted to know. As the clouds made the day dark, and she pulled her Macintosh tight and crossed Chalk Farm Road between the cars with their slotted headlights that made them look as if they'd just arisen after a heavy night and were fumbling for the tin of aspirin, here was what she wanted to know. Was one meant to feel certain about love? She carried on down Chalk Farm Road, lighting a cigarette and exhaling a little of her buoyancy. Her feet seemed to touch the pavement again, and it was wet, and she noticed the water stains on the mid-tan leather of her Oxfords. After their last dinner, the slightly too much wine dinner, they had gone for a walk on Hampstead Heath in a mist so thick as to have been almost a paste. You could have lost your gloves in the fog and found them half an hour later, still suspended in the air at wrist height. She had tried to get them lost in the vapours, but he, misreading the situation entirely, had piloted them back to safe streets with a quiet and unerring skill. If it had rather irked her that she must contrive to produce in Tom the behaviours her mother insisted held primacy in all men, then she had forgiven him on the spot when he gave her a shy, proud smile. Her heart had lifted in her chest, as the magazines insisted it must. She remembered him like that now, transported from cares, his cheeks damp from the mist, and flushed for once with something other than embarrassment. Was it love that she felt? Or did she just find him sweet for not allowing them to become lost on Hampstead Heath, and only discovered years later with her Macintosh in tatters and his beard down to his knees? Mary hurried on and tried to pick out the landmarks. The worst of it was that people were still high on the intrigue of the war, and prone to suspicion if you asked them for directions. Such people, and they were not always joking, would ask you who was the Prime Minister, as if no enemy spy could possibly speak the name without combusting. How much better it would be to ask her, "If you are one of us, then how, hypothetically, would you know if the trembling physical feeling you had for a man, say, 5 years your senior, handsome without being a knockout, and from a slightly inferior social background to your own, but not in such a way that it was necessarily a problem, provided that you remembered to show him the right way to hold a sherry glass before he met your father, how would you know if that feeling was love?" The worst thing would be to decide that it was love, and then discover, after one was taken, that it hadn't been. No, the worst thing would be to decide that it wasn't love, and then to discover years later, old and unconsoled, that it had been. No, the worst thing, the worst, worst thing, was this having to decide. She sighed and turned left into Hawley Street. She hadn't had a moment to really look at the school until now. It was a grimly masculine building, red bricks set off in three frugal bands by courses of hard London yellows. The windows rose from wide sills to Gothic arches. The gables were decked out with barge boards and topped with lanceolate finials. Mary thought these the most fun bits of the building, these spikes aimed skywards, impalers of trespassing angels. She stepped from the gloom of the street into the dark of the school, and used her cigarette lighter to find the switch. The bulbs came on down the corridor. Mary wrinkled her nose. There was a lot of dust, thin in the centre of the corridor and deeper at the skirting boards where the draught had piled it into drifts. There were the tracks of gnawing creatures, the serpentine lines swept by their naked tails, and a crusting and crumbing of the dust where their urine had soaked and dried. All this dust, and the shuttered school smell of inkwells and spitballs and apple cores gone rotten in desks. What could she do about it all, alone, even with soap flakes and an optimistic outlook and 3 days to go until Monday morning? The quiet, too, was unsettling. Into this air, multiplication tables had been recited, the changeless alphabet chanted, the four house songs sung in quadratic symmetry. The Lord's Prayer had been intoned by impish voices with every imaginable variation and subversion, and now the unceasing hymn was struck dumb. If the war so far was a phony one, this silence was real. She went from classroom to classroom, switching on the lights. She tried to brush off the solemn mood that was settling on her. Of course, a school made one feel rather alone. The rows of desks in each room, the stacks of identical hymnals, the massed coat hooks lining the wall, the multiplicity of everything was bound to single one out. She went first to the classroom, Kestrel's class, that had been hers in September. She realised it wouldn't be suitable. It was robust enough, all the classrooms were built from spine and vim in the good Victorian manner, but it wasn't close enough to a basement. She walked the corridors, opening doors until she found one that led down wooden stairs. Below ground, the smell was older. She found superannuated atlases in tumbling piles, with the earth's poles marked by whirlpools. There were the musty props of ancient school plays, Tuck's staff, Banquo's shroud, Peter Pan's cap. A maypole lay askew, bound in its own ribbons. In the glow of her lighter's flame, the hoard stretched away into blackness. 50 children could shelter down here if needs must. Mary knelt to sift the treasures. Here were cross-stitched samplers and mouldering report cards with examination results for needlework and recitation. Here were handwriting exercises with passages dutifully copied. At the door on summer evenings sat the little Hiawatha, heard the whispering of the pine trees, heard the lapping of the water. She felt 5 years old and 500. Here was the remainder of 10,000 educations. The bones drifted down to this depth. It was the fossil of one's country. She ached, because the war had cut the thin cord that bound each child to its ancestors with links made from cross-stitch and calligraphy. She walked up into the corridor. The school was absolutely silent. How violent it was, this peace where children's voices should be. The ache in her chest hardened to anger until she shook with it. Sparrow's classroom was closest to the cellar. She gauged what needed to be done. The boards would have to come off the tall windows, for a start. If a raid came, well, that was what the cellar was for, but until then her classroom would be a place of light. And the dust would have to be swept, and the mustiness purged with vigorous airing. If a ladder and paint could be found, then she would get the children to restore these walls to white. This parquet floor would scrub up. These chairs would rediscover their elan after a once-around with screwdriver and sponge, and as for the desks with their intricate chronicle of graffiti, either they could be sanded bare, or the opinions of generations of pupils could be allowed to stand. Mary found that she didn't much mind either way. Beyond the superficial errors of spelling, there was little that she felt justified in correcting, after all, when she read the collective wisdom concerning Miss Vine. At the front of the classroom, the mice had got onto the teaching desk and eaten the carton away from the chalk, so that it lay splayed. They had eaten the bitter leather from the corners of the gym mats piled in the corner. They had taken the barren seeds from the bean bags that were used for throw and catch. They took what the war could give them. Mary gathered the chalk and found a pot for it. She wrote her name on the blackboard, Mary North. Then, to see how it might look, she rubbed out North and wrote Tom's surname, forming the letters slowly and carefully in the exemplary hand required for blackboard work. When her fingers gripped the chalk, the pink blood shrank from the knuckles so that something of chalk's nature seemed to seep into her. Mary Shaw. To see how it might sound, as she turned from the board, she said brightly to the room, "Hello, class. My name is Mrs. Shaw." She lifted her hands to her mouth. Tom was standing in the doorway of the classroom. His efforts to disappear were, to his credit, but unsupported by a pitiless physics that refused to let him vanish. He squirmed and tried to shrink behind the door, and gave up on that, and instead pretended to have been whistling a tune. He gave up on that too, since if he really hadn't heard what she had said, then here it was, inscribed on the blackboard in the Marian Richardson script, that was favoured for the modern and unambiguous manner in which the letters were made. "You silly girl," she thought. "If he has any sense, he will never speak to you again." And the worst thing about it, as she watched his resigned smile, was that she really did like him a lot. His awkwardness was gone in this moment, when it finally couldn't matter any more. There was something honest in his surrender to the situation. It was only now that she understood how difficult it must have been for him to like her and to be petitioned by her at the same time. All he had needed was for her to understand that things should be taken carefully and slowly. She dropped her hands and mirrored his sad smile. "Sorry," she said. He watched her in the half-light of the electric bulbs. "No," he said. "It's I who should apologize, Mrs. Shaw. It seems that I am late to this class. Have you already taken the register?" She hesitated, then beamed. "Oh, I mean, well, as it happens, you're in time. I was just about to do it." He gestured at the rows of desks. "Oh, so may I..." "Yes. Oh, yes, sit anywhere. No, actually, sit down here at the front, where I can keep an eye on you." She invested her face with the appropriate severity. He took a desk in the front row. His knees came halfway to his chin when he sat in the tiny chair. He laughed. She frowned. "Settle down." From the drawer of the teacher's desk, she took a pencil and the register book, blew off the dust, and opened it to the first fresh sheet. At the top, she wrote Sparrow's Class, Spring Term, 1940. She wrote Tom's name on the first ruled line.
"Tom Shaw?"
"Present."
"Splendid," she said,
looking at his name on the clean page.
"Well, you are my first."
April 1940.
"I'm quite sure you're doing it wrong," said Hilda, wincing as Mary dug the comb into her scalp.
"This preposterous hairdo is wrong. I'm following the instructions exactly."
"Oh, do give it here,"
said Hilda, snatching American Vogue and jabbing at the illustration of step three.
"See? It says to tease, and you are backcombing."
"I am teasing."
"You aren't," said Hilda, "and I should know."
"Oh, do it yourself, then, if you're so good."
Mary threw the comb onto Hilda's dressing table, where it clattered against the china pigs she kept there. She lit a cigarette and flopped on the end of Hilda's bed.
"All right," said Hilda. "I'm sorry. Perhaps it just wants more lacquer."
"I've used half the can already. It's against nature."
"You're jealous I thought of it first."
"Hardly, Hilda. What we see laid out in these instructions is not a hairdo. It is a folly."
"Then it is a folly everyone's wearing this season."
"And therefore you suppose that officers will be attracted to it?"
"With all this hairspray, they'll be lucky if they don't become part of it."
"You should carry emergency solvent, in case you need to unstick one."
Hilda made a pleading face in the dressing table mirror.
Don't leave me half done like this. I look like Frankenstein's mistress.
It's an improvement.
Charming. Is that how you are with the children in your class?
Oh, no. As Miss North, I am sweetness and light. That's why I have all this frustration to take out on you.
Have you any more pupils yet?
Still only four. One Mongol, one cripple, and two that barely speak.
He's done you proud, that man of yours.
Mary stubbed out her cigarette.
It will take time. More will come once the parents realise that there isn't to be any bombing.
Still, if it were me, I shouldn't bother. It seems an awful lot of trouble to go to, opening a school for the sake of four no-hopers.
That's the difference between us. I want a better world, you want better hair.
Hardly an end in itself. I want the hairdo so I can get a man in uniform.
Mary sighed, stood, and picked up the comb again. Hilda smiled at her in the mirror, and Mary returned the favour.
Your face is not entirely dreadful to behold, you know,
said Mary, angling Hilda's head.
You might almost pull off this look, in conditions of very low light.
Sadly, your flaws as a friend would be visible in pitch dark.
You are indolent and asinine, said Mary.
You are obstinate and self-satisfied, said Hilda.
Mary worked as well as she could, segmenting the hair on top of Hilda's head into bands, front to back, and pushing each band in turn down to its roots with a comb until it developed sufficient body to bolster itself. It was rewarding work, what with gravity being such a bully and hair so plainly the underdog. Hilda's scalp was warm, and the air in her room was pleasantly fogged with lacquer and cigarette smoke, while a fresh rain lashed the window and ran down the pane and caused Pimlico to warp and swim.
"And your mother?"
said Hilda after a while.
"Barely seen her in days. I had hoped to show her the school. Now I'm no longer pretending. But she is too busy whoring for father. He is set on becoming a cabinet minister, and of course there are luncheons and functions.
I'd murder to have your mother. If mine has ambition, then it is somewhere at the back of a drawer.
Yes, but here is the war, don't you see? Shaking everything up. Father's world seems so small now. All those closed committees of men who were at school together. All the beaming wives competing, all of us daughters racing for husbands when the trap opens. Glossy fillies that we are, keeping dutifully in our lanes.
Just so long as you stay out of mine.
Careful, Hilda. Remember who has the hairpins.
Well, don't come crying when you grow out of your little pauper.
Tom is hardly poor.
He lives in an attic, for pity's sake. You told me so yourself.
Yes, but
an attic, Mary. I'm sure you don't love him at all. You only love the idea of your mother's face when she meets him.
Mary ignored her. She layered the bands of aerated hair, starting at the back and working towards the forehead to make a gratifying mound.
It's the same reason you write to that negro, said Hilda. It's to say to your mother, look at me. If I were you, I would simply go to her lunches and dinners. Smash the teacups if you must. Kiss the Minister of Aircraft Production. But at least do it when your mother is jolly well watching.
Mary fixed her with a pitying look.
I write to Zachary because he is a human being.
Is that what you told his father? He must have been impressed.
Mary turned Hilda's head left and right in the mirror, a little more sharply than was absolutely necessary.
I told him that he might consider bringing his child home, and that I could assure him of a school place with a shelter in the event of any raid.
"Did he look at you like this?" said Hilda, making a rubbery grimace and widening her eyes to make sources of incomprehension.
"He wore a coat and tie like any man and received me very civilly."
"Did you make him presents of coloured glass beads?"
"He told me about his life in America."
"And counted the spoons when you left?"
Mary gave Hilda's hair a last blast of spray to set it.
"Your attitude is just like society's."
"Oh, good," said Hilda.
Mary lifted the hand mirror so Hilda could see herself from the back.
"Interesting," said Hilda.
"What is?" said Mary.
"Nothing," said Hilda,
supposing that it would have to do until she could get to the salon. May 1940. In the garret, Tom lay back against the bolster and drew on the cigarette Mary put to his lips. The cigarette's pull lit them up, flaring and fading again. Outside, wardens policed the blackout. Light, which had always united the city in a universal glow, had shrunk back into points. It was its old self again, a privateer, a dweller in nooks. People sheltered flames from draughts. Shadows grew by accretion, thickening nightly, as if the day wouldn't rinse off the dark. Tom blew smoke at the ceiling. Mary curled her foot around his. He held back a laugh.
"What?" said Mary.
"Nothing."
"Tell or be sorry,"
she plucked at the hairs on his chest.
"Ow! I was just thinking how different it feels."
She looked wistful as she tapped ash from her cigarette.
"You won't love me any more, now that we've done it."
"It isn't that."
"What then?"
"Actually," he said, "I was thinking how much more I love you."
In truth, this is what he had been thinking, that from now on, at work, on the bus, in the park, he would have more fellow feeling with dogs who were sexually experienced than with men who were still virgins.
"And what were you thinking?" he said.
Mary was thinking how much she was enjoying the war. The passions, which had been confused against the general glare, could flicker in the blackout. With love, one could glow. One did not need the intense flame after all. Now she could feel as she did, happy, as the ancients evidently had and her mother probably hadn't. The capital's heart had moved from Pimlico to Piccadilly, where the loud circus of electric bulbs was silenced, and Eros, unsighted and teetering on his pedestal, now loosed his arrows into the dark. London lit her up from the inside. The great diurnal city learned the language of the night. She said,
"I was thinking I love you."
"I love you too."
"But you're a man. You'll move on to plunder the next settlement."
He nodded. "Primrose Hill."
"Or Hampstead."
"Can't I plunder you a bit more first?"
She inspected her nails.
"From time to time, I dare say, if I have nothing on."
"I like you best when you've nothing on."
She flicked his thigh.
"Dirty old man."
"I'm 24. "Yes, it's indecent."
He worried that it was.
"I do love you, you know."
"But do you really?"
"Yes."
"But do you really, Tom?"
"Absolutely. I'd show you the readings on my dials, but we would have to open the inspection hatch in my chest."
"Could we? I should like to be sure."
"I did bring the right tools."
She rolled onto her back and blew smoke in a slow blue jet.
"I hate you."
He frowned.
"You can't prove it."
"I haven't got dressed for you. I won't even get out of bed for you."
"Not even if I do this?"
"Especially not if you do that."
She put the cigarette to his lips again, and he drew on it. The flare lit up two pale discs in the darkness of the garret. Caesar's button eyes, watching from the top of the piano.
"For God's sake, cheer up,"
Tom told himself involuntarily. His muscles tensed.
"What's wrong, darling?"
"Nothing," he said, but the moment was broken. She rolled onto her stomach to stub out the cigarette.
Tom realized, with a guilty ache, that he hadn't thought about Alistair for days. Lately, his friend's letters made him miserable. Of a long march with heavy packs, Alistair had offered,
"The trick is to wear two pairs of socks, one thin and one thick."
Of life in barracks, he had written,
"It is gayer if one takes the view that it is butlins with guns."
There was no substance. His last really personal letter had come months ago, in December, when Alistair had written rather rawly about a soldier who had been blown up in training. Since then, the distance between them had started to show in the letters. Tom tried to put Alistair out of his mind. It was 4 o'clock on Saturday morning. The wine was nearly finished. They had another hour of darkness before the daylight came. Mary rolled onto her back and lit up again, and he put his hand between her thighs. She blew a smoke ring.
"The war is amazing.
Is that terrible to say?
Well, I shouldn't go writing it on the blackboard.
I am 19, and I have a school of my own. I can teach the children however I like, and I can hug them when they graze their knees.
Tom thought it was lovely that she was so happy, but it was a shame that she was still talking, given that his hand was where it was. He said,
"You'd have found something terrific, even without the war."
"You and I wouldn't have been thrown together. Thinking about it makes my head spin. Imagine how many there are, like us, at this moment, lying in bed because the war has brought them close. In Cairo, in Paris."
"Yes." He moved his hand between her legs. She said,
"In Germany too, I suppose."
This caused his hand to stop. The continuation should have been natural. There should have been bliss, and instead here were the Germans.
"Steady on," he said.
"The Hun do not go to bed with one another."
"Well then, and how do they make little Hun?"
"In factories on the Ruhr, according to detailed blueprints. I don't know." He wished she would leave it. Beyond the four corners of the bed, the world could go to hell, and seemed determined to exercise that privilege. To speak of it was to bring it under the covers with them, into the warmth and the darkness. Now he couldn't stop thinking of it. Far out there in the night somewhere, his best friend was shivering in a bunk, with bromide in his tea and postcards of Betty Grable. He felt guilty again, and sighed.
"What's wrong?"
Mary said.
"It's just that I feel such a shit."
"Whatever for?"
"For not joining up. For being here when the world is there."
Mary stubbed out her cigarette. The movement set the bedsprings quivering. His hand, between her legs, could neither sensibly advance nor retreat now, but simply cupped her, foolishly, with its own instinctive tenderness. She said,
"You aren't meant to be a soldier."
"Why not? I could fight."
"You couldn't shoot someone."
She stroked his face. It seemed to him that her touch traced his limits.
"I could kill if I had to."
Immediately he felt the absurdity of it as a boast. She smiled. He flushed.
"Well, perhaps you don't believe it, but I could."
He took his hand from between her legs, propping himself on one elbow in the dark. She flicked on her cigarette lighter. In the provisional light it made between them, she looked at him so calmly that he was ashamed.
"God," he said. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be."
She snapped the lighter shut, and in the quick darkness he saw the bright negative of the flame. She rolled onto her side and took his hand and put it back between her legs.
"If they call you up for the war, go. Until then, don't spoil it."
"Mary, I..."
"Shh, darling. Let's not let the war win."
He moved his face close to hers.
"When I said I love you before..."
"Yes?"
"I didn't mean it. But now, I think that I do."
"Oh, yes. Oh, me too."
Tom understood why the good actors in the movies never said it with a smile. To be in love was to understand how alone one had been before. It was to know that if one were ever alone again, there would be no exemption from the agony of it. It wasn't the happiest feeling. Afterwards, she laid her head on his chest and yawned. Her copper hair spilled over him. They shared a cigarette, and her face, with its sheen of perspiration, reflected the orange glow. He said, "Do you want to sleep?" She considered the question as if the idea were new, then shook her head. It was raining, and a grey light loomed in the garret, threatening to return all things to their quotidian form. Tom felt the grip of an unnameable fear, but Mary lit another cigarette and smiled at him so impishly that it restored his faith. The bright sexual smell of her, her slightly comical frown of concentration, her breasts quivering as she worked the wheel of the lighter, her slim belly as she sat up in bed to find the ashtray. The rain came in squalls, hard as handfuls of rice against the window. He made them both tea, in the jam jars they used for cups, and climbed back into bed,
They sat against the headboard and leaned shoulders. They were tired, their eyes cast inward. They forgot to sip the pale tea. The steam condensed on the inner rims of the jars. He said, "Have you ever been, you know, in bed with anyone before?" She blinked. "Oh, yes." As if it were nothing. Tom's fear returned. He supposed he had been perfectly prepared for her answer to be yes or no, but this third possibility had not even slightly occurred to him, that perhaps it really was nothing. It had seemed the most important thing that had ever happened to him, but of course he had been a fool. He felt as if he could easily cry. He wouldn't let himself, of course. He would set his face just like this, in this worldly grin. And when their conversation naturally picked up again, he would engage in the new topic with all levity, as if, yes, this were nothing, and that therefore this feeling he had, that he had been struck through like the clumsy first draft of a letter, were nothing, too. And still. He realised he didn't mind if she had slept with 5 men or even 12. He just wanted Mary, who had trembled in his arms and crushed her face into his neck. He just wanted Mary to speak about what had happened as if it were something. Tears threatened again, and he stopped them. She was digging him in the ribs. "Darling," he said, keeping his tone light. She prodded him again, and he turned to look. She was watching him strangely, and he didn't understand. There was so much, he now realised, that he did not understand. He had lost his virginity, sailed to a place where land had been marked on the chart, and yet here was just more open sea. He could not decipher her eyes. An anxiety came over him that she wanted them to make love again. He didn't know if he could. Then he worried that perhaps making love was not what she wanted at all, and that maybe this strange and terrible look she was giving him was something else, a prelude to the sort of conversation where she would be serious and kind. She would speak softly, noticing the lateness of the hour, and saying that perhaps they should sleep after all. And then, as soon as the time was decent for young women to take to the streets, she would excuse herself and leave. He stroked her cheek. How pathetic he was. She had seen his reaction, and she must think him ridiculous. Now that she was certain to leave, he understood that he did not even care if she felt nothing for him, or for any of the men she had slept with. What he could not bear was to be without her. How dreadful the days would be from now on. How empty. She smiled. "What is it?" he said. "I haven't slept with anyone else." "So why?" She took his hand. "I wanted to see if it counted for you." Above them, the dawn sounded with engines. Tom drew the blanket around them. He held Mary close in the improvised darkness. How bedclothes would protect them, he didn't know. The engine noise drew nearer and increased in volume until it was directly overhead, rattling the windows. Then it faded away to the east. Aircraft were being delivered, or pilots trained. That was all. And afterwards they laughed at their own fear. At sunrise, with the rain blown over and the wet pavements gleaming, they went for a walk. They wore the clothes they had worn to the dance the night before, since Mary had no others, and Tom saw no need to let her be the only one. They strolled easily together, holding hands and swinging their arms, and making no strenuous effort to avoid the puddles, being both of them protected by love against discomforts of any kind. The streets were still nearly empty. London was theirs alone, and if from time to time it pleased the lovers that a bread van should drive past on its rounds, or a policeman walk by on his beat, or the last fox of the night nose for scraps in an alley, then they caused it to be so. They strolled until the pavements grew busy around them, and the traffic began to clot in the streets. They walked, and they did not need anything at all, until very suddenly they needed everything. They understood that they were famished, and so they ran into a cafe and ate like wolves.
They drank dark, stewed tea that made their teeth buzz in their sockets. Afterwards, he decided that he must absolutely buy her a book, and she decided that she must absolutely buy him a paper knife, and they went in and out of shops until these things were done, and then they were calm again. They sat together on a bench in Trafalgar Square, holding the new things in their hands, and being delighted with them, while Tom also felt solemn, in a way that had no limiting degree. They watched the grubby pigeons flock. She yawned and laid her head on his shoulder.
"Are you tired?" he said. "Shall we go back to the flat and sleep?" "I ought to go home. Palmer will fret."
"Your dog?"
"Yes," she said, and wondered why she had.
The distance between them was nothing, and simultaneously it was so huge that in the moment she had not found the heart to speak of it. She felt a heavy sadness.
"What are you thinking?" he said. "How glad I am. What are you thinking?"
He was considering the idea of her having a home, a pet, two parents. He had not given any thought at all to the concept that she hadn't simply materialized into the world at 18 in perfect crimson lipstick, laughing at the exact spatial coordinates and the exact time at which he had first met her. She was so perfectly unique that the idea of her being made ordinary by friends, oh, and worse, by family, made his chest sink unbearably. He said, "The same. So glad." She kissed him.
"I should go."
"Oh, yes, yes, of course." He gave her an anxious look.
"What do you suppose you should tell your family?"
She stroked his cheek.
"I shall tell Father I stayed overnight with my friend Hilda. I shall tell Mother you are lovely."
"You'll tell her?"
"Women share everything. It's the blessing we received when we turned down muscles and moustaches."
He squeezed her hand. "I'll walk you to the tube." She didn't tell him that she never caught the tube. She wondered if one bought a ticket beforehand, or whether there was an inspector who came through the carriage. They got up from the bench and walked back across Trafalgar Square, breaking into a run to scare the pigeons. They ran, breathless and laughing and desperately sad, with their hands clasped tight and the birds clattering up before them. They flocked and swirled and ascended through the city's blanketing cloud, emerging into the sky, a life unmoored from the embattled earth, a thing begun again, looping and wheeling in the Pacific air. Mary held tight to Tom's hand and thought it heartless that the two of them had to stay below, in London. She said,
"I'll be fine from here."
"I wish you hadn't to go."
"Just until Monday. Come and pick me up after work."
"But will you be all right?" She said,
"Why would I not be all right?"
He thought about her question. In fact, there were so many reasons. Of course, there was the war, which he increasingly believed might bring death from the sky at any time, despite his own insistence that the thing would fizzle out. Then there were orders which could come quite arbitrarily, posting either of them to another city or another country, where distance would begin to work its curse of transforming a lover's hand into handwriting. There were mechanical accidents. Machinery was well known to be full of spite for slim bodies such as the one he now clung to. Bearings lived to seize, axles to shear, cables to snap. Accidents of the heart were a worry too. She was beautiful. Other men could see this as well as he. She was bright and unconventional, and her faithfulness could not be assumed. There would come suitors who were taller or richer, or, most dreadful of all, who could make her laugh. How he feared men who could make her laugh. Next there was disease. Less of a threat than good humour, but still not to be entirely discounted. Influenza came once in each generation, and was overdue in theirs. Cancer or consumption might take her. A scratch on her finger might fester. A cold sore give ingress to a greater chill. There was a whole category of mishaps, inseparable from physics, the tumble, the slip, and the choke, collision, combustion, and shock. And, of course, he could not even begin to quantify the risks posed by third parties. Friends might queer her affections,
Fiends in alleyways might murder her, or worse. Her parents, picking from a list of his faults, might seize on his pacifism or his poverty. They might set about dissuading their daughter, using all the tricks of their art. It was not a level playing field where parents were concerned. They had known her in every year of her life, he not yet in every season of the year. Finally, there were the imponderables of memory and the psyche. She could wake up tomorrow with no recollection that she had ever known him. Or she could walk past the cafe and stop dead in her tracks, overcome by desire for the waiter. And worse than all of these things, because so much more likely, were the mundane human dissatisfactions that absence would allow to incubate. What if he had said something to unsettle her? A single word could be enough, and she, brooding on it, came to decide that he did not truly love her. Or what if he had been unsatisfactory in bed? The more he thought about it now, the more he worried that there was something he should have done, but had not, or worse, something he had done too much of. At times they had moaned like animals. Surely this was monstrous. Surely in solitude she would now reflect with shame and not wish to see him again. These were only the first thoughts that came. The more he considered it, oh, God, a lovely face with that mocking little grin, the more causes there were for anxiety. Separation was air in the lungs of fate, and so when it was time for them to part after their first night together, and he asked her, "Will you be all right?" and she replied, "Why would I not be all right?" in fact, so many reasons presented themselves that it immediately began to seem fantastically improbable. If he let go of her warm hand now and allowed her to walk away into this grey morning that smelled of spring, that they would ever see each other again. It seemed so much safer to stay close, and to let the great disintegrating power of the world do its work on other lovers instead. But since he did not know how to put all of this in a way that would not seem pathetic, he simply said, "All right, I shall see you on Monday." It was not the same as charging down a machine gun nest armed only with a Bowie knife, or strapping into the tail gunner seat of a four-engined heavy bomber, and no one else would ever know, of course, since one did not get a medal for letting go of a woman's hand on a grey Saturday morning in the middle of a European war. But to have faith that a lover would be constant and life clement, this did require courage in a city more disposed to beginnings than safe continuations. As she walked away from him, he turned his back to show that he could. For her part, Mary did not find it at all difficult to walk away from Tom. She simply walked for a while, wearing yesterday's clothes. Yes, the war was a blind roulette. Yes, the city was full of beautiful women who might tempt him, some of them more thrilling than she was, a few already wearing summer dresses. It all weighed less heavily on her, since weightlessness was in her nature, and because in any case one simply had to live. "Oh, and yet..." "Darling?" she called, spinning round. The crowd had taken him, though. She had imagined that he would still be standing there, watching her. And now she felt a dreadful uncertainty about love. June 1940. Vapour trails twisted high above Alistair's train from Dover. He angled his head out of the window into the warm slipstream, bitter with coal smoke. He knew the RAF was milling rings with the enemy up there, but from where he watched, the aeroplanes were invisibly small, and it seemed as if the steam from his own locomotive rose up into those thin and tortured contrails, as if nature had congealed and gases no longer dispersed but only bifurcated and twisted around themselves, as if there were no more forgetting. The train's whistle screamed. London was close now, with an ominous gravity that clutched at his cells. He had meant to visit Tom straight away. That was the point of coming to town. But now that it was so near, he felt he ought to settle himself first. He would fire Tom a quick note for the afternoon delivery, use the day for some errands, and see his friend in the evening. "Dear Tom, they have given the regiment leave, which we have surely earned with our magnificent display of backwards marching all the way through northern France." He put the pen down for a moment, reaching for the right tone.
The enemy had run them ragged, from the first failure in the Ardennes to the final evacuation at Dunkirk. The Germans had had more concentration, more conviction, more force. When one thought of the enemy, it was with a queer mix of fear and admiration.